WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Black History Month comes to a close, we've been closing the show each day this week with contributors to the New York Times 1619 Project. 1619 as in the year enslaved Africans first arrived in what became the United States. Joining me now is Anne Bailey, professor of history at SUNY Binghamton and author of The Weeping Time, Memory and the Largest Slave Auction in American History. Her piece for the 1619 Project is called They Sold Human Beings Here. Welcome back to WNYC, Professor Bailey. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
How are you, Brian? I'm good. Thank you for asking. You write about how in 1808, Congress put a ban on the importation of enslaved Africans, but there was still a domestic slave trade?
Yes. So, it's more than Congress, but starting on the British side, there was this ban on the Atlantic slave trade. So that's the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. And so Congress followed suit. So to say that, technically speaking, there should have been no more slave trading across the high seas. But the fact is that that meant that now there was increased pressure and intensity placed on those enslaved persons in the United States who now could be bought and sold within a kind of a domestic trade. So that's why in the 1800s, that's why there is this incredible increase of the number of slave sales, as much as 1.2 million, we estimate, between 1760 and 1860.
And you're right, the sales took place all over the growing nation, in taverns, town squares, and train stations, on riverbanks, and by the side of the road. Can you talk about, if anybody could talk about this, how a sale would go from the perspective of an enslaved person?
Well, from the perspective of an enslaved person, first of all, they would never know the exact time or date this could happen. So you have to think about that level of uncertainty that you live with on a daily basis. You're living on a plantation, and you have, in many cases, you've tried to eke out some kind of settled family life. And that was one of the few bright spots of slavery, is the extent to which family life was really prized, and those relationships were so important to the enslaved. But at the same time, you know, if you're a mother or a father, you live with that, the fear that at any point the slave owner could decide that they would like to sell your son or your daughter or sell you away from your children. So that's the first thing, that it's this great level of uncertainty that you live with and you try to mitigate, but there's no way to completely plan for that. Secondly, when the auction is announced, you can imagine there are all kinds of levels of negotiations or decisions that are made. Should they run away? Should they stay and try to plead to keep their family life intact? Most of that falls on deaf ears, as you can imagine, because most slave owners, when they decide to sell slaves, it's for economic reasons. And they're doing it because they want to pay off a debt. They're doing it because they want to, you know, give money or a wedding gift to a child, a grown child. It's that kind of thing. They have their own objectives. And for the most part, they're not really considering the family lives of these enslaved persons.
And you're right that immediately after emancipation, some newly freed people went back to auction sites for a specific reason that was not obviously to relive that traumatic experience. Can you explain why they went back?
Well, you know, what we find when we look in the slave narratives, for example, is that, you know, whenever they mention where they were auctioned, this would, of course, have an indelible mark in their mind. So what's interesting about this, Brian, is that there are no markers for the most part. There are less than 50 sites across the country that are marked as auction sites or slave sale sites. But yet, you can imagine for the thousands of people who were sold, this would have been marked in their minds and hearts forever. So that's one issue. But the second thing is that, you know, from a very practical perspective, they're going to be looking for their people, as they say, right? They're going to be looking for their family members, and they're going to be looking for whatever clues they can find in that area, if that's the area where they were sold, or if they were fortunate to find out where they were going to be sold to. So if, for example, like in my book, The Weeping Time, there's an engaged couple that are separated and they're sold separately. So one goes to North Carolina, and you would imagine that a few years later at the end of the war that they would be looking for one another. They know that they went to North Carolina, and so that would be mm-hmm. one clue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not much of a clue,
yeah.
But it's something. If they had the name of the new slave owner, if they had the state, but if they didn't, they absolutely would consider coming back to the place where you know, this particular trauma took place, because at least they could start to find some kind of clues as to where to find their loved ones.
Wow. So for the last 5 months, I see you and your research assistants have looked through archives to try and expand the historical record about America's slave auction sites. How many have you found?
Well, we have found, well, first of all, we know that there are hundreds, if not thousands. You know, we know that just from the record, the fact that so many people were sold. And they can be found, we will eventually be able to identify a whole lot more as we look at various different types of records. We chose to focus on slave narratives, and we chose to focus on an archive of digitized ads or advertisements that were placed in newspapers, so that as soon as the Civil War was over, what you had is that you had these enslaved persons placing ads in, you know, newspapers across the country, very simple ads saying, information wanted. We're looking for a sister who looks like X, Y, and Z. Last found, or we left her at this site where she was sold, etc. So we chose to look at those records first, because we thought to ourselves that that really gives the slaves agency, that really gives them that sense of, it's as if we're searching the way they were searching, right,
mm-hmm.
with the information that they had.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, there are many other records and many other archives that we should be looking at in the future to be able to locate these various sites and to tell these great stories of these men, women, and children.
And in our last minute or so, I know you're right that after the Civil War, most former auction sites quietly blended into the main streets of today because of the desire to paper over the atrocities of the past, and many of these sites were forgotten. But then it's shocking what some of them may have been. Like after Thomas Jefferson's death, his estate sold 133 of his enslaved workers at two different auctions, and you believe that one of them was on or near the West Portico steps of Monticello, and that's exactly what's on the back of the nickel.
Yes, it is. Those famous steps, and, you know, when you go to Monticello, you know, you would typically hear about the stories, and you would have read about this if you read anything about Jefferson, you know, famous people, you know, other presidents and past presidents and so forth would go up and down those steps. And you don't really associate these famous, beautiful steps with an auction, but it's quite likely or possible that an auction took place there. To Monticello's credit, they do acknowledge the auctions that took place on the property.
Mm-hmm.
But the other auction that was another part of Jefferson's property, that took place in downtown Charlottesville. And there is no specific mention of the fact that Thomas Jefferson's enslaved the enslaved people from
just real quick, and I'm going to jump in because I want you to be able to tell our listeners what you're looking for their help with. Can you do that in 15 seconds?
I can. First of all, if anyone who's listening knows anything about other marked sites that for somehow we have not seen or we have not located, please let us know. If they know stories, including oral history stories, because we have ways of checking whether or not actual sales took place there, we hope they will get in touch with me directly or with the New York Times. abailey@binghamton.edu.
abailey@binghamton.edu.
Or to the Times.
Professor
yes.
Of
or
History
to the New York
at,
Times Magazine.
Right. At SUNY Binghamton and author of the book, The Weeping Time, Memory and the Largest Slave Auction in American History. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.